Welcome back to the Dynamic Nonprofits Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Saunders, and we have a really cool conversation coming up for you in just a few seconds about philanthropic psychology. It's a favorite topic of mine because we spend so much time as fundraisers coming up with A/B tests and how to optimize our fundraising, but we don't spend nearly enough time talking about why donors give. And I think that is so critical to being a better fundraiser and improving those tactics. And we have a great guest to walk us through that discussion and lend some of his expertise, and that is Clay Buck. Clay is a founder and consultant at TCB Fundraising, and we are thrilled to welcome him onto the show right now. Clay, how are you doing today?
Dan, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, we are thrilled to have you and really excited to walk through this really interesting and I think under-discussed but very important topic as fundraisers to understand. And that's why donors give and what drives giving. And before we dig into our topic today, we want to give the audience an opportunity to get to know a little bit about you. So if you wouldn't mind, would you walk us through your origin story in fundraising and tell us a little bit about your journey and how you ended up where you are today with TCB Fundraising?
Sure, of course, happy to. I always tell people I'm a recovering actor and reluctant data geek. So I started out to be an actor. I have 2 degrees in performance, both in theater. The longer version of the story, I moved to Chicago in 1996 after finishing my master's in acting. I'd been working in a couple of theaters in admin, you know, over the summers and so forth, and didn't realize that what I had been doing was fundraising, right? Asking, you know, patrons to help support the theater and, you know, all kinds of things. And so I get to Chicago and realized that I hated auditioning, like hated it. And B, needed to keep a roof over my head. So I got assigned a temp job and wound up temping as a grant writer. And because I'd had experience doing it in working with theaters, that turned into a full-time job. And then it sort of grew from there. So like many fundraisers, like most fundraisers, I kind of fell into it, but was very fortunate at the beginning of my career to have strong mentors. Who really taught me the theory and the practice and the rationale behind what we do, and found that I really loved it. So I worked for a number of organizations in Chicago for a while, moved out to Henderson, Nevada in 2002, where I worked for a large consulting firm, spent some more time as a frontline fundraiser here in Las Vegas, and launched my solo firm, which has always been a dream of mine and a goal. So after 30 years in fundraising, launched my solo consulting firm just a couple of years ago. And now I get to work with nonprofits on building individual giving programs, which means particularly at the low and mid-range of the donor pyramid, which means I get to do a lot of direct mail and a lot of digital, a lot of strategy, and a lot of good stuff in really opening up philanthropy to as many people as we can and inviting the community into giving, which I think is the greatness of the work that we get to do as fundraisers.
Absolutely. And thanks for sharing your background with us. And, you know, Clay, you're not the first person that I've spoken to who has a background in theater. No, is there something about, and this is what is so great about fundraising, is that it's such an eclectic industry and virtually everyone, myself included, didn't formally train or go to school for this. So you get a very eclectic background with people with all kinds of different skill sets. Is there something about a theater background that you feel has been helpful for you during your fundraising career?
I think so. And I think there's something about the skill set that comes with performance training, particularly, but theater training in general, that kind of lends itself to the wacky world that is fundraising. Because think about how many hats we wear, right? We got to crunch data. We got to tell good stories. We have to be good in person in making asks and listening, knowing the process, building systems. And I think that there's something about the theater training, right? We're taught how to be on stage. We're taught how to present. We're taught how to talk. A big part of actor training is active listening. and responding to stimuli on stage and in performance. And then, of course, you get all of the math that goes into and science that goes into scene design and lighting design. And, you know, I often joke learning how to create light plots in a lighting class was kind of the best training I could get for database management, you know. So there's a lot of crossover skills. And I do think one of the key skills is presence. Is learning to be present, and that which is a critical skill for fundraisers. And you know, theater people are emotional people. We're tied to our emotions, and that's what brought us into the theater. And I think that's what brings a lot of people into fundraising, is that empathy and the heart that goes into it.
Yeah, and I think having a theater background requires a certain degree of authenticity and being comfortable Correct. With your emotions. And now as we talk about as an industry, Right. how important authenticity is, to me, that plays right into that theater background, that you're completely comfortable with that. And also being responsive to an audience on mm-hmm. being, knowing how to read people that you're talking to, incredibly mm-hmm. important skill set for fundraisers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because again, part of performance training is energy. So you're working in a scene with another actor and they're way up here and you've got to meet that energy, and then they come down here and you go, and especially in major gifts, especially in one-on-one, especially in presenting and dealing with boards, right? Being able to read the room, pick up the energy, respond to it, actively listen, and be present in that moment, whatever that moment may be. You know, plus we're really good at, if we got to put on a suit and a tie, it's just a costume, right? It's just a costume and a role that we're playing. And, you know, if we're putting on jeans and a t-shirt and going out and helping program service, then we're good at that too. So
a lot of stagecraft, whether you're designing a landing page or designing a mail piece, a lot of stagecraft involved in direct mail and getting the audience, the donor, to sometimes suspend disbelief for a moment. That's a way I've always looked at direct mail in general.
It's Stanislavski's The Magic If. That's what we're doing in a direct mail letter. What if, right? And if you know the work of Lisa Sargent, she talks about this a lot too, of bringing in that what if world and imagining that world. But it's funny that you say that about direct mail, because I was just talking about this last week. Setting up a good direct mail pack, the design of it is just like creating a story on stage. How much white space do you have? What's filled in here? Where do you want the eye to go? What are you drawing attention to? Yeah, I love that you said that, because it's 100% true.
Yeah, and this kind of gets into our conversation about psychology, but one of the yep. things that's always fascinated me about personalized or authentic looking direct mail is, does the donor believe that it came off the desk of the executive director? Are they willingly suspending belief?
Yes.
Does it matter? Those yes. are the things that fascinate me. And
yes.
With this talk about authenticity is, I think sometimes as fundraisers, we become a little bit cynical and say, well, no one's going to believe this, or they're going to think that this tactic is hokey. But if you touch on something and you get them to buy in, I think it's always kind of important to look at that from that perspective as well.
I just wrote this down. I hadn't thought of it in that way, Dan, but you're right. The willing suspension of disbelief from the envelope, right? From the moment the envelope arrives, or the email subject header line, whatever it is, right? Is the recipient, is that donor willingly suspending their doubtful nature, right? Willingly suspending that, yes, I can make a difference in the world, and going into that work. Ah, it's beautiful. I'm stealing that.
I wish I could take credit for it. It was something that was told to me by a client that I've worked with for a very long time, who's been in the industry for decades. And it really made a lot of sense, because it changes the way you think about things like handwritten fonts. And you don't look at it as cynically and say, well, if this touches on something and it gets the donor to suspend disbelief and open up a little bit, it's not a ploy. It just makes you view things differently. It's always been helpful for me. So glad that I could give that little tidbit to you on the fly. That's the beauty of these conversations.
It is.
As we're talking about donor psychology, there's no shortage of consultants out there, but there is a shortage of consultants that spend a lot of time talking about this aspect. Can you give us a little bit of background of when you started to become interested in the psychological aspects of fundraising, and why you think it's such a critical part of being a consultant or being a fundraiser?
First and foremost, let me say and add to that conversation about kind of falling into fundraising, because when I started, there were no training programs. Platforms weren't doing content marketing. We had, you know, Cy Seymour's book, and we had Jerry Panis's books, early books. You know, we didn't have training programs and certificate programs. Now we do. And I think it's amazing and a phenomenal lift for the sector. We are actually seeing young people come in intentionally and earning degrees and so forth, which makes it an exciting time to be in fundraising. It also makes it a critical time to be in fundraising because there now is so much content and training. We got to be sure it's good. You know, just because there's training out there doesn't mean it's all quality. So now teaching discernment and understanding discernment in what is good fundraising training and having that background, which is how I got to the donor psychology and how I got to this kind of intent. The story there is a very long story made short. At one point in my career, about 10 years ago, someone who replaced me in a job, in a consulting gig, said to me, what's the big deal about fundraising? It's just asking for money. And of course, you know, I was shocked to my core and offended. And no, it's about relationships. I couldn't answer the question in a way that satisfied me and that satisfied him. I couldn't articulate the answer of what the uniqueness and specialty about fundraising was. So it started me on a deeper path in researching. It's when I started blogging and writing and presenting. Because if you can teach a thing, then you know a thing. To answer the question for myself, what is fundraising? And it led me into a lot of the great work and research that is being done now, and the actual psychological studies and information that we have on driving behavior in a digital world. We are able to capture intent and, you know, and so forth, so much more, right? So really dug in intentionally to answer that question. What is fundraising? What is the work that we do? And by extension, what is philanthropy? What is giving? Why do donors give? Because if you think about it, it's a really kind of weird, odd, non-logical value proposition, isn't it? It's not a rational behavior.
No.
I spend all of my time, I spend the majority of my time in a job that pays me money to do a thing. And that time that I spend earning that money to do a thing keeps me away from my family, the fun things that I want to do. Of course, we'd all much rather sit around, you know, by the ocean and while our days away and whatever we want to do, but we have to work. So then I go and work and I earn this money and then I give some of it away to make this thing happen. That's not rational. Like, right? So what is it that drives this behavior that ultimately led to the work of Drs. Adrian Sargent and Jen Shang at the Institute for Sustainable Philanthropy. And that's where I really committed into leaning into this philanthropic psychology. They offer a course, a certificate in philanthropic psychology, which I took, and it was one of the hardest 12 weeks of my professional life trying to balance a job and dig into all of this psychological research. But the reality is we have actual data and research and know what motivates human behavior, and understanding the intent behind human behavior. And if we as fundraisers can leverage that and use it, not in a mercenary way, but in a fulfillment of what a donor's desires are, then that's really where we get into the magic of the work that we do.
Absolutely. And I guess with that, I mean, this is like asking what the meaning of life is, but right. I'll just ask you, and you could take it wherever you want, and let's see where the conversation goes, but why do donors give?
Well, okay. Hopefully we all know. Anybody that's done surveys and works in data, you know, understands the ideas that what people will tell you in a survey is what they think they do. So if you ask donors why they give, they'll say, it's because I believe in the cause. And then when you actually really dig into the data to see why they give, there's thousands and thousands of real reasons why they give. I often say there really is no such thing as true altruism. There really isn't. We all do things because we get something from it. When we talk about board leadership, why are you on a board? you know, honestly, if you're on a board because it networks you in the community and you're getting connected to other people that you want to be connected with. And so you serve on a nonprofit board to do that. My feeling is, as nonprofit leaders and fundraisers, let's understand that and use that to help fulfill that board member's or that donor's identity. And that's this is what comes from Dr. Shang and Dr. Sargent, that identity of who they are. So why do donors give? Well, fundamentally, they're going to say they give because they believe in the cause. The reality is they give because it tells them something about themselves, and it fulfills an identity and a thought of who I am as a person in this activity. In other words, I am, we all think this, really, really bad, I was stumbling over words there, right, to use the right word, but really, really bad, evil, mean people don't walk around thinking of themselves as really, really bad, evil, mean people. Everybody walks around thinking, I am a fundamentally a good person. I'm a kind person. I'm thoughtful. I'm generous. I'm hardworking. This is who I am. And giving, the act of philanthropy, fulfills that identity for a donor and helps them say, yes, I am a good person because I'm the kind of person who cares about homeless pets or hungry people or, you know, whatever the cause may be. I'm the kind of person who believes that we should have scholarships for students to my alma mater, right? This is how I think of myself. So the act of philanthropy, the act of giving, then becomes an action that fulfills my own self-identity of who I am as a person.
And I think that's a really important point. And I wish I had some data on this. Maybe you do. But my perception is that most people who do give don't advertise it to the world. So when we're talking about self-identity, we're not talking about virtue signaling. We're talking about helping somebody fulfill part of their identity internally. Correct. And I think when you look at it that way, I view what you said as, I don't view it cynically that there's a manipulative aspect to this. I think in some ways it's a gift because you're helping people find an extension of their identity and something they clearly resonate with, as well as making them feel good. And to me, that is why the element of donor gratitude is so important. And to Bingo. Me is a really low hanging bar when we talk about ways to get donors to come back and to improve retention rates, and that it's not manipulative. It's something that I believe most donors truly seek is they want to feel good about what they're doing and helping the world. And when it was described to me as a fiduciary care to the donor, that you're thanking them and you're reminding them of the good that they're doing, and you're giving them that dopamine hit that you're doing good by the donor by doing that. So, you know, and thinking about this as identity, not just supporting a cause, but something that's intrinsically important to the donor and part of their being, it seems to me that it makes it more obvious that we should be focusing on the area of donor gratitude and how can we continue to remind donors about the good that they're doing and making them want to come back and do it again.
Let me just digress for just a second.
Sure.
Because I actually do believe, right? There's multiple identities and multiple thoughts that are expressed when a donor gives. And there are transactional donors. There are donors who give to get something in return. And there are donors who give for non-altruistic reasons, for tax benefits and all of that. Great, fine. But let's understand that. Let's understand that that's what that is. Our goal, though, and our quote unquote best donor, right? Let's not value the dollars. Every dollar is a good dollar unless it was achieved unethically or came from unethical sources, but right? Every dollar is a good dollar. Every donor though is different. There are transactional donors. There are donors who give for a myriad of reasons, but what we are really looking for, our goal as fundraisers, is finding those donors whose identity is wrapped up in our mission, who is connected to the mission. So Jen Shang and Adrian Sargent have again pulled together this research. I'm going to throw a little data at you, right? There are three types of donor motivation. There's the situation-based identity and the situation-based motivation. In other words, there's an external environment that motivated the giving. Think event donors. I gave because I was at an event and I got wrapped up in the emotion of the event, or, you know, I was there for the paddle raise, or I was at the golf benefit. So the situation is what motivated my giving. Then there's the relationship-based donor motivation. In other words, I was motivated to give because of a relationship that I have with someone. So think peer-to-peer, which is going gangbusters lately, and bravo, yay, it is, right? That relationship-based, I gave because someone asked me to. I think about this a lot in animal rescue. I gave because my friend's dog died, so I made a gift in memoriam, right? Relationship-based. But then there's the third and the highest level is that identity-based. In other words, giving motivated by who we are as a human being. If we as fundraisers can leverage those relationships into identifying and the activities into identifying and helping to find those donors that are identity based and find our true core of donors and their true core of identity, that's where we really hit the magic spot, if you will. And to your point, that dopamine and that gratitude, that's what the gratitude is about. So even if we have donors that come in through events, or we have donors that come in because of a relationship, we get into the mode of, because Dan, you are somebody who cares about pets that need homes, right? And we keep reinforcing that identity and we keep showing back to the donor through the gratitude that we exhibit who they are. Then we get into this and we help to reinforce and prime that identity with that donor, right? Then we get into a really fascinating realm of who they are and how they give. And it becomes, as you so often hear, it's not about the transaction, it's about the transformation.
Yeah, and I think this all ties into something that we don't talk nearly enough about, but donor motivation. And what motivates that donor to give is, I think, highly predictive of whether or not they're going to stay on, but also what kind of messaging that they need to stay on. When I first started in the industry, one of the first things I learned on this front is that in a mail piece, if you use the word membership instead of one-time gift or one-time donation, if you reinforce membership, you're going to suppress response. You're going to boost average gift. The people you acquire are going to be more valuable because they view themselves as holistic members. They're not tied to an individual issue. So it's very similar to that. So I think my question, and this could either be firsthand perspective or things that you've heard in the industry or just your opinion, is how do you identify donor motivation, and how do we identify the donors who are motivated by their identity versus those who are motivated because of a relationship or another reason?
And, you know, you and I both live in a world where we know there's all kinds of data that you can append. And, you know, even more so than when I first started, when it was all about magazine subscriptions, and that's what we had to go on. Side note, who was it? Somebody said this online just the other day, and I wish I could credit them fully. But the models that we use now in identifying donors, in some cases in list acquisition and list, and I know this is your world, much more your world than it is mine, but are based on some of those, the old category descriptions from the 50s and 60s, which are very based in old economic patterns and in some levels of white supremacy and dominance in middle-class culture, that's how we built it and we still kind of use it. So we are in a world where we need to look differently at how we invite and bring donors in. But we can't append, we can't append all kinds of data to it. And we can get suppositions of what we know based on their demographic behaviors. I think at the end of the day, what we have to go with is we have a transaction. The donor made a gift. And we can see where that gift came from. Did they respond to the direct mail piece? Did they give to a peer-to-peer campaign? Did they give at the event, right? We see the source of the gift, and that tells us where it came from. What then we have to look at is, how do we respond? And if we respond in a transactional way and just treat it as a transaction, then that donor is going to see it as a transaction as well. So I tend to think and work on taking an assumptive identity approach. So if you do make a gift to a peer-to-peer campaign, my recommendation is we come back immediately with Dan, because you're the kind of person, your thoughtful gift, your kindness, and we start to just plant those seeds in that identity right from the outset and assume that this was a truly altruistic gift based on their identity and take that assumptive approach into it. And we set a communications response and an acknowledgement response that primes that identity throughout that cycle. We are taking the step forward. Now, we might find the donor go, that's not me. I just gave because Jack asked me to, right? Okay, fine. And we understand that. I have become a data guy. One of the trendings that I see, and a lot of my colleagues in data laugh at me because I ask for 10 years of giving history, but one of the trends that I see the most is what I call consistent but non-consecutive donors. So over a 10-year period, they might make 7 gifts to your organization. They give a couple of gifts in the first year, and then they don't give in the second year, and then they give one gift in the third year. And then in another year, they give to an event, right? So if you look at that 10-year history, or even a 5-year history, you're seeing this giving, sporadic giving all over. What they don't look like is, I am a donor who gives every year, year over year. My belief is that those donors who give consistently but not consecutively are walking around going, I'm a donor. I support Acme Charities, right? They think of themselves as a donor, but by our strict definitions of renewal and retention, they're not. So we're over here going, we've got all these lapsed donors and they're out walking in the world going, I support pets, right? So by looking at the second part to your question, sorry to digress so far here, but the second part of your question is by looking at history. Where are looking for those donors who have given multiple times in multiple ways in and at different timing, not just falling within our strict guidelines of year over year retention and things like that, but looking at that person who has given multiple times, whatever level, really is saying to you, I care. It's up to you to make me care more and to value that caring, right?
So it's really getting past just looking at MRC and looking at, okay, well, this person hasn't donated to our organization in 24 months, but they donated 5 times before that, maybe not every year, but periodically. So,
right.
You know, chances are somebody doesn't just stop caring about a cause, something made them stop giving, or they just haven't been approached in the right way. So I think in terms of practical advice, that's an excellent tip, is to look at your file and look at people who have given multiple times in the past, but maybe are not falling into your house file based on how you're pulling based on MRC, and address them in a different way. Talk about Correct. Their values, and because they're such a great person and so generous because they've supported you in the past, and give them an opportunity to renew that generosity. I agree entirely. I think in terms of, besides all the other things that we've talked about gratitude and ways to improve retention rates with personalization and improve messaging, I think it's things like that, looking for pockets of donors that you can reactivate with a different kind of approach. And certainly you called them consistent, but not consecutive donors.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great starting point for any organization. And Absolutely. You know, if you're a larger organization, you're probably talking about a fair number of donors who just are not popping up every year, but are demonstrating their commitment to your cause, even if it's not in consecutive years. That's tremendous advice. How do you feel about, I've heard it referred to as zero party data, surveying the donor after they make a transaction, either online. Another version of it that I tend to be really fond of is thank you calls, where you're not asking for anything. You're just saying thank you and saying, why did you choose to support us? Do you think small steps like that, could that help organizations also get a handle on who's donating and why to their cause?
100%. 100%. What we really need, though, is strong understanding of surveying techniques, because all surveys are biased and we build inherent biases into our surveys without thinking about it. And we'll plant the seed, you know, Dan, why did you give to Acme Charities? And the first choice is, because I care about the cause. Well, of course you're going to choose that, right? So really design, and there's great work being done on this by a number of different organizations and different vendors and thought leaders. But if we use the survey as a donor-centered tool to really convey to the donor, look, this survey isn't about us. This survey is about you and helping us help you fulfill, you know, what your intent with your philanthropy is, right? Can we get away from net promoter score? Oh, I'm sorry, just a soapbox moment. Net promoter score in a donor survey has no bearing on anything. Would you recommend supporting Acme Charities to your friends? Of course they're going to say yes, but are they? Come on. Anyway, that's just a latest soapbox issue. But yes, first party data. Let's find out why. Let's find out real reasons why donors are giving. One thing, I'm sure you've seen this in campaigns. One thing that is tremendously successful that we don't do enough of in the sector is, and I include it, I don't know if you do, but I include it on reply forms in direct mail pieces of including a spot. And I include it on web pages, including a spot for donors to tell their story. You know, just a blank space to say, hey, Dan, tell us why you care, right? Or tell us your story about, you know, whatever. Donors love it. And I always see it be tremendously successful. I've run a couple of story campaigns where that's all it is. It's usually digital, right? And we create a unique website and it's just tell us your story. Tell us what it is. What do you want us to know about? And being able to capture that and engage in dialogue just changes the game in how donors relate to us and how they think about it. Because if we can get them telling their story, then we don't have to tell the story as hard. They've already convinced themselves.
And the other side of that is making sure that that information is ending up in a place where you can utilize it. And that's where I'm a big proponent, if you've listened to any of our content, of what I call unsiloed fundraising and bringing together not just different departments of fundraising, but different departments within the organization. And so the phone call example is one where you can have your communications team that handles thank yous reaching out to the donor. But if they're going to ask, just curious, what drove you to support us today? That information has to go somewhere where it can be utilized. Same thing, what you're talking about, writing in their story on a direct mail reply. I agree. That's a very powerful tool. And the best fundraisers I know read all of their comment mail,
yep,
good, bad, and otherwise, because it's amazing what you learn. And sometimes it's even not even solicited, but donors that are willing to supply information, it's extremely valuable. I think that by the same extension, organizations are not utilizing their social media comments properly.
Not enough.
As a fundraiser, yeah, I go through a social media page and I read comment section. I can tell what drives people to respond, what they're enthusiastic about, what they're critical about. And a lot of that information never makes it to the fundraising folks. So in some ways, I think we have a lot of this information, but certainly to your point, we should be trying to get more of it, because the more you can understand who's giving, because this is integral to their identity, those are the donors who you want to focus on and you want to feed and ultimately, I believe, are going to be the most valuable. Because this was a really powerful quote that was said to me, people are less likely to walk away to something from something that is part of their identity.
Yes.
We walk away from transactions. We don't walk away from things that are part of who we are.
Two real quick things, though, if I may, on that front. Number one, oh, but the donors are going to complain. Good. If donors are complaining, it means they care. You know, the opposite of love isn't hate. The opposite of love is apathy. So if we send out a pack or something that donors complain about, great. Let's hear those complaints and understand that they cared enough to feedback to us. Number two, the tactical side of it, the flip side of this is the organization that tries to capture everything and then becomes so inundated with data that they can't move. So the capturing side of these kinds of stories and comments does have to be strategic, because we can overanalyze and we can get too much data. And I am thinking of organizations that have so many notes in their CRM system, they can't make a decision on a donor. I can't do anything because I got to review all these notes. I mean, let's make it actionable, make it easy. This is a whole other podcast episode. But being strategic about how we capture it. And the last point, because I totally stole the mic from you, I'm sorry. You knew this when you invited me on that I go off on tangents. In American society specifically, but in general, we have two ways of exercising our democracy. The first is our vote, and we hold that sacred, right? And our vote is how we believe in democracy and how we exercise it, and is really true. If you really think about it, political giving and political activity really gets into identity. This is who I am and what I believe. The second way is with our philanthropy. And if we in the sector can start acknowledging that, that by exercising philanthropy, people are demonstrating they're demonstrating their democracy, they're demonstrating how they live and what their identities are, and we see philanthropy and giving as that exchange, and start to value that and recognize donors of all levels, of all backgrounds, gifts of every level, that philanthropy is about this identity and people investing in the world we want to see. That's where I think the revolution in fundraising comes now.
Absolutely. And you never need to apologize on this show for stealing the mic. I love guests that steal the mic. And I love conversations like this. I mean, this is what I miss and what I can't wait to get back to, meeting in person. I mean, yeah. I've learned more about fundraising over a glass of wine at the Bridge Conference than,
of course.
I mean, those are the most productive conversations. So,
of course.
No. We appreciate your insight. On the identity point, I didn't plan on bringing this up, but I think it ties into the conversation. One of the things that I've been putting a lot of thought into is the role that nonprofits can play in rebuilding community. I'm sure you're familiar with the data that Americans are walking away from all kinds of sources of community. The most notable is the decline in the number of Americans who consider themselves to be religious mm-hmm. or attend a house of worship, but also things like labor unions and other types of membership organizations like VFW. We just don't have as many sources of community as we used to. And during the pandemic and to a broader point online, I see all these online communities popping up and I see people are hungry for community, even though we're walking away from it in the physical world. So to the point about trying to encourage and build and cultivate identity within donors, should nonprofits be looking at things like hosting local meetups for donors and trying to build community? Because to me, if your nonprofit that you support is part of your identity and also something that you have communal ties with, to me, that's a very strong relationship and something that in many ways is filling a void that is has been left by other things that people have walked away from.
Look at the growth in individual giving, again, particularly in the low and the mid-range during the last year during COVID. What donors told us is giving gives them agency. It helps them feel control over an out of control situation. It's why we see crisis giving at hurricanes and fires and floods and national tragedies, right? I can't do anything, but I can give. What I fear is the interpretation of what you're saying of, well, we're going to host another event. Okay, the events are, listen, you know, we can all go on about events, and there are donors who like to exercise their philanthropy at events. So let's make it possible for donors to exercise their philanthropy in the ways that are meaningful to them. I do think donors crave community around a common cause. Can I reference a specific charity? Is that all right to do?
Absolutely. And, yeah, absolutely.
I know we talk a lot about it. I know there's some, negative feeling about it. But I signed up to be a monthly donor with Charity Water because I had a professional curiosity. I wanted to see what everybody was raving about. I have now become, because they are so good at what they're doing, I almost encourage every fundraiser to do it just to see how they do it. I now consider myself a water advocate, which I didn't before. I cared about clean water, but now I consider myself a water advocate. The thing that they do so well is when you're a member of the monthly giving club, they... 2 weeks ago, they invited us, donors that were, part of the monthly giving group, to an internal discussion on a Facebook Live group about creativity and developing creativity. It didn't really have anything to do with water per se, but it was the creative directors behind their work. Of course I went. Like it's creating, go back to what you said, creating authentic value, creating value in community that isn't always about giving, but is about that advocacy and that identity of who I am. Because we tend to think, and it's hard to manage these things. I know they're tough, right? And the ROI on it, we got to look at it, all of those things, but creating these really valuable, engaging opportunities for donors to come together. What a phenomenal, like I am a huge pet advocate. I've mentioned it how many times, you know, rescue pets, right? What a phenomenal opportunity to get all the people in a community together that care about rescuing animals under that umbrella. We have ways to do this now online, in person, and donors will do it themselves. They're going to organically do it. We had a situation here in Las Vegas over the pandemic where people just weren't getting food. And a group of people relatively organically came together and went, we're going to talk to these restaurants. We're going to buy food from the restaurants. We're going to get it to hungry people. And it came together and now has become this great groundswell of community engagement. So short answer, yes.
But not, this is not another fundraiser. I agree.
Correct.
I agree. I think about if you have an organization that's an environmental group or is dedicated to preserving open space, you host local meetups for people to go on hikes together, things like that. You're trying to foster connections on a human level. And yes, we have to be mindful of the ROI, but I think as fundraisers, we should be open and receptive to the idea of testing our time, how we're spending our time. So if you look at a couple communities and you say, okay, let's organize a couple of meetup groups. Let's track these people over a few months and see how does their giving behavior changes. You might find that fostering these connections might be one of the most valuable things that you can do with your time, because it just adds another layer of depth to the relationship and it moves it further away than just being one of those transactional things that we spend money on when we want something to feel good about. It really is, to your point, going back to the beginning of our conversation, it becomes part of your identity and integral to who you are. So I agree. If you're going to think about events, don't think about fundraising, think about building human relationships. And it doesn't necessarily need to be directly related to your mission, just something that your donors you think will share a common interest in. And remember, we are starting with donor files of people who inherently mm-hmm. have common passions. So
correct.
It shouldn't be difficult to add on to that.
And let's throw in the caution of, let's do this without objectifying our beneficiaries.
Yes.
Right. You know, let's honor and recognize that it is the problem our beneficiaries experience, not them as people, because we can tend towards, you know, let's bring all of our beneficiaries in and show them off. Nope. Right. Let's build honor and respect for our beneficiaries and build equality between our donors and our beneficiaries. It's this three-legged, it's we, us, and our, right? It's donor plus beneficiary plus mission. That's the three-legged stool that we're operating under. And we can do this and build community around help while honoring and recognizing the humanity of the people that we serve.
Yes. And that issue definitely doesn't need to be forced. I mean, I just had a conversation on this show about some of the best donors are beneficiaries who go yes. on to become donors. And then organically, some of these things happen. And then all of a sudden you have a really powerful advocate for the organization. But yes, if you're thinking in terms of let's bring our donors and beneficiaries together in a way that's just not organic, that feels really uncomfortable to me. If you have a beneficiary outreach program, those things I think can happen organically, but it should be in a way that's tasteful and not exploitive at all. I agree that
I agree.
That makes me very uncomfortable if you're trying to force the issue. I would almost say you're better off just leaving it about building bonds and connections between the donors if you don't have a system in place to integrate correct. Beneficiaries. I mean, you should absolutely do that, but it needs to be thoughtful, as you said.
Correct. I tell this story frequently. I will tell it again here. It is my favorite story of my career. And I know we're coming up on time. So just quickly, we did an event, a nonprofit that I worked at, a breakfast event. And we invited a young woman to tell her story and how she had experienced our mission and all of that. And her mother, of course, we invited her mother to be there. And the mother, I happened to be sitting next to the mother at the table. And when the time came for the ask, right, like you do at an event, everybody reached, thankfully, reached for their card to fill out their donation. And the mother reached over and went to grab a card. And I put my hand over and I said, no, you're our guest. We have invited you here. You are a guest. You should not feel obligated at all. We welcome you, you know, you're part of this community, the whole thing. And she looked at me with huge tears in her eyes and said, Clay, who am I to accept this help without also providing it for others?
Wow.
And I know the people we serve, the communities that we serve, right, are as much a part of this philanthropic partnership as we are and our donors are. And that to me just so solidified for me that connection of community is powerful. And that's what our beneficiaries are saying us. And that's what the donors want to be a part of, is this groundswell of really making change and really making something powerful happen. That to me is where the identity comes in here, that I am the kind of person who wants to see this change in the world.
And that's the kind of story to look back on, is if you're ever having a rough day, if you think about what we do, I mean, no job is perfect. No career is ever going to be perfect, but ours does come with the benefit of the good we're creating in the world. And that's just an amazing story, which kind of helps you keep things in perspective. And on that note, as we prepare to wrap things up, Clay, I try to end each interview with a question that I think each guest is uniquely qualified to answer. And this just popped into my mind. You were talking before about marketing, and fundraising is such a mix of art and science and storytelling and data. It truly is marketing that I think in many ways is more challenging than how we traditionally think of marketing. How do you think we can better tell the story of our industry and what we do and the true marketing value of fundraising, if that makes sense?
I am relatively known for my stance on fundraising is not sales and fundraising is not marketing. And I will sit and argue those points for months and years. Because I believe fundraising is a legit profession with its own structures and responsibilities and all of that. So I tend to balk at describing fundraising in marketing terms. And that said, right, the truth and the reality of your question is, tell better stories. Tell true, authentic, real stories with respect, with honor, and acknowledge there is a problem that needs to be solved. And we all can do something about this problem. Every nonprofit exists to solve a problem. Somebody founded a nonprofit because they saw an issue in the world and they went, we can tackle this. And whether we're tackling the symptom or we're tackling the root cause of the problem, there is something that we can do about it. And I truly, truly believe investing in telling that story of the problem and how it can be overcome is where all of our materials come from. Our solicitations, our marketing, our messaging, everything maintains its root in that.
Well, I think that's a great perspective, and I agree. I'm reluctant to want to cross the streams between fundraising and for-profit marketing. I also think it's important to tell the story about what we do, the impact we have, and the tools that we use to do it, because I want this to be an appealing profession for aspiring marketers and understand that there's a viable career path. And I think that's where sometimes I'm conflicted, is how do you do that without commercializing the work, but also selling the good that it does, but also its viability as a career path. And those are just kind of some things that I spend time talking about. But I appreciate your perspective. And I agree that the best way to make it stand out is the stories, and to say that your efforts and your talents can make this happen. And those individual stories are as powerful as they come. You mentioned Charity Water is as good of a charity as I know at highlighting the power of those individual stories. Well, Clay, this has been a real treat. I really appreciate you spending some time with us today and talking about donor psychology and a number of other things that I know the listeners will find valuable. If our listeners would like to get to know more about you or to get in touch, sure. What's the best way for them to do that?
I'm on Twitter an awful lot, at tclaybuck. I'm also on LinkedIn, easy to find. But my website is tcbfundraising.com. And it's got my contact info and everything there. So one of those three routes and you'll find me.
Yes. And I'll definitely give a shout for your Twitter presence. That's how I became familiar with you and a lot of the cool things and interesting things that you talk about there. So I hope our listeners will give you a follow, reach out. Well, Clay, this has been great. Thank you so much for taking the time today and for having this conversation and for everything that you're doing for the industry.
Dan, you are great at this. You're a fantastic interviewer and conversationalist, and I just appreciate your time and your kindness in inviting me. See what I did? I just primed your identity as a host. Right? There you go. A little active lesson there.
Well, those are kind words, and that's a real honor coming from you. I appreciate it a lot. Thanks a lot, Clay. Have a great day. We will talk soon.
Look forward to it.